Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. I hope you had a chance to get some rest over the weekend. On Mondays, I spend time talking about the economy and what has happened since the COVID-19 pandemic changed the way we live our lives. NPR's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell is here with me, as he is each Monday, to look at the latest developments in the economic pain Minnesotans are feeling. This hour, I also have two of my other most excellent colleagues joining me. They have been doing a lot of reporting on the spread of COVID-19 in Minnesota and how it's affecting families, hospitals, and long-term care facilities. And we are taking your phone calls. Do you have a question or a concern about the surge in COVID-19 cases here in Minnesota or the restrictions that are in place to try to slow the spread of the virus? You can call us at 651-227-6000. Again, that is 651-227-6000. Tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. Let's get started with the latest developments and what we're seeing with COVID-19 and how the state is responding. On the line right now, I have Catherine Richard. She's an NPR News senior reporter based in Rochester, and Catherine has been covering the coronavirus pandemic. Good morning to you, Catherine.
Good morning, Angela.
Hi. We also have Peter Cox on the line, and he's also a reporter here at NPR News who covers the aging beat, as you may know. And most recently, he's been doing reporting about what's happening at long-term care facilities. Hi, Peter.
Good morning, Angela.
Hi. Good to have both of you with me. First, I want to know what it's been like for you personally, reporting about the spread of COVID-19 and all of the loss and the pain that has come with the pandemic. And Catherine, you're regularly writing about and tweeting about those daily briefings that we hear from the Minnesota Department of Health. What's it been like for you?
Well, thank you for asking that question, Angela. It's been a little surreal, and I've said a few times that I've actually been really grateful to have this job right now because I think it helps distract me from what's actually going on out in the world a little bit. You know, I've got three small kids at home. They have not been in school since March. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our household has been very busy. So that's been very distracting and in maybe a positive way. You know, at the same time, I feel like there have been moments in my coverage of this pandemic where I have really been struck by someone I've spoken with or a story that I'm hearing. I think I've gotten a little immune to some of the numbers and the grief and all of this. So occasionally I will do a story that just really sticks with me. I'll give you an example. A few weeks ago, we started hearing the hospitals were really at capacity, and kind of out of the blue, I started having doctors and nurses just call me, people I've never met before, to say, "This is really bad. You need to be reporting on this." And hearing the fear in their voice and hearing them cry on the phone to me was just remarkable. And I think just sort of drove home again for me how serious this is, because I think sometimes that daily coverage just makes you feel a little removed from what's going on. So I'm grateful that people keep reaching out to me to sort of keep me grounded in my reporting, and keeping that empathy has been important.
Yes. Yeah. So many people in the community have stories they want to share because they want to get the message out about how they've been affected by all of this. And so, Peter, what has it been like for you? Because, you know, the interviews are difficult right now. The information is hard to share.
Yeah. I mean, I think one thing is usually in my beat on aging, I'm meeting people face to face, and because of the pandemic, I have not been able to do that. So it's made reporting challenging, and especially on this beat, and not wanting to put people in danger just talking to me. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, kind of echoing what Catherine said, I'm repeatedly like in awe of the people who are working in this industry, and it's been an especially difficult year for them, clearly. But even coming into COVID, long-term care had a terrible staffing problem, like just not enough people working in this industry caring for people who are at end of life stage, and they've been through the ringer, and they've lost a lot of people they work with. And I've just over and over, people talk about losing people in a long-term care facility, like losing family members. They're working with these people every day, sometimes for years. So I think it's just worth remembering, and it's something I try to think about often. It's just kind of what kind of stress these people are under and what they've been going through.
Absolutely. Catherine, we know every day at 11 o'clock on the Minnesota Department of Health website, they give us updated numbers on new cases and the new number of deaths. And what are you seeing from today?
Sure. So there are 24 additional deaths, about 6,300 new positive cases, which really tracks with the numbers we've been seeing, you know, over the course of the last almost 2 weeks now, about 57,000 tests. So, you know, that's high testing, again, tracking with what we're seeing. You know, so I think these numbers don't stand out to me in the sense that they're any remarkably different from what we've been seeing over the last 2 weeks, but certainly remain really high and troublesome to public health officials.
I remember when the numbers are, you know, of new cases, it was like, oh, 300 new cases. And I was like, wow, 300 people tested positive yesterday. And so when we talk about it being in the thousands, it really is mind blowing.
It is. And I would say, too, that we always have to keep in mind that we're looking at the proportion of new positive cases to the number of tests that have been done. So when we test more, we will see more. But when those numbers aren't going down, even as we're testing more, mm-hmm. that's when public health officials really start to get worried. And that's really why we're under some of these new restrictions. That, paired with the hospitalization situation, is why we're here today.
So let's talk about that. Those new restrictions imposed by Governor Walz last week took effect over the weekend. Remind us what's changed, first with restaurants and bars.
Sure. So restaurants and bars are closed for in-person service right now. They can do takeout. On top of that, if you are planning a wedding reception at this time of year, you cannot have that wedding reception. The other notable thing is that there's been a pause on youth sports, and they're really stressing the state has essentially prohibited gatherings with people outside of your household, although they have no intention to enforce those rules over the holidays. They're just trying to make sure people stay home, don't gather over Thanksgiving over these next few weeks.
And fitness centers also, and gyms.
Fitness centers too, yeah.
Again. And then this is just for 4 weeks. Why 4 weeks? Do you think they said it's paused?
Yeah, I actually asked this question to Commissioner Jan Malcolm, who's the head of the health department, last week. And they landed on that for a few reasons. First of all, it kind of gives the virus some time to work its way through the population. So that's two transmission cycles. And it will help them understand if the mitigation efforts they put into place starting Friday are actually having an effect. Now, at the end of that 4 week period, what they're really going to be looking for is hospitalizations to go down, as well as new cases and that positivity rate I talked about earlier. You know, the other reason they chose 4 weeks is because we know that the new positive cases that we have that we're seeing today and did over the weekend are sort of locked in. Like, some of those people will end up in the hospital, but what we're doing now really can affect what the situation looks like in like 3 to 4 weeks. So that's why they chose that 1 month period.
And who is getting sick? Who's dying? Could you describe what we're seeing in terms of age?
Yeah. So the numbers pretty consistently remain in the older level. So people who are older, people who have pre-existing conditions, and age being one of them, are more likely to have severe versions of this virus, to end up hospitalized and to mm-hmm. die. You know, that being said, we also see that this virus disproportionately affects people of color, indigenous people, black people, Latinx people. So there's those trends are really consistent in Minnesota, but also nationally as well.
And Peter, what are you seeing as we do look at the older folks? How are they faring when it comes to COVID-19? And what are they sharing with you about their symptoms and what their experiences are once they're hospitalized?
Well, yeah, as Catherine said, you know, this is affecting older people, people with pre-existing conditions in a worse way. There's a CDC study that just says the risk of hospitalization from COVID-19 in a person who's like 85 years or older is 13 times more than a person in their 20s. So clearly there's a higher risk, but also just the percentages we've seen so far of cases and deaths, it just gets higher as people age. I think it's around 14% of cases of people in their 80s so far, and about a quarter of people in their 90s who get it. So we really see it ramp up at certain age levels.
And let's talk about what is happening inside long-term care facilities when it comes to COVID-19. Yesterday, I believe it was the Minnesota National Guard. They tweeted that 500 soldiers and airmen from the Minnesota National Guard have been activated to assist in the state's COVID-19 response. And they've completed temporary nursing assistant training over the last week to be ready to assist long-term care facilities in Minnesota. Many of these places are experiencing staffing shortages due to COVID-19. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so as I said at the beginning, staffing was already an issue coming into the pandemic. But also, what tends to happen is once a facility gets hit with this, they have a lot of people out. I talked to a long-term care facility campus coordinator in Albany, Minnesota, last month, and he said in one day, they had, I think, one positive case. And within 24 hours, there were 16 people out who'd either been exposed or tested positive. So you can lose a lot of staff members very quickly. Mm. So there's been a few different ways the state is trying to help these places. And one is they have a database of people who can work in long-term care, either nurses or other people who can work in those facilities who are on call. But right now, because so many facilities are being hit, that's really being stretched. And so this is why we're seeing more and more National Guard out helping. And I expect that to kind of be the case for a while here.
Absolutely. We're talking about just the latest developments in the COVID-19 pandemic and the state's response to it with NPR reporters Peter Cox and Catherine Richard. We're also taking your phone calls. The phone lines are open. The number is 651-227-6000. And in Wilmer, let's take a call from Steve. Hi, Steve.
Oh, hi. How are we doing today?
I'm all right. I can hear you well. Go right ahead.
So try to keep it short, but the question is, knowing that there's two kinds of tests when there's multiple different types of tests, but you have your COVID-19 test to determine if you are have it, mm-hmm. and there's the antibody test. My question is, and knowing on reading some more on this, and that there, and which is an important thing too, is I think the potential long-term effects that we're finding out more and more on that, but if you have the regular test, that tells you that you're contagious. But what if it's 3 or 4 weeks later? Does that test still work? Or do you need to try the antibodies test? And the reason I ask is because my wife's in the education field, mm-hmm. and she's had a test 3 different times, but they were always because of potential close contacts. And they've always been negative, but back in April, she's had some symptoms that are similar to the things that we're hearing about now, about, you know, dizziness, unexplained headaches, stuff like that. So kind of my question is, I don't think the test would necessarily tell you if it was a month later.
Right.
But the antibody test might. Is right. that how I understand that correct?
Well, let me ask Catherine. I mean, we're not doctors, sure. Catherine, but what are you hearing about this situation with testing, and what does the antibody test show?
Sure. Great question. So the PCR nasal swab test, that's the one where they stick the big Q-tip mm-hmm. up your nose and take a sample. That one is most effective for people who are currently infectious, like people who have the virus right now. And they're pretty accurate, although we do hear anecdotal reports about false negatives occasionally. Now, the antibody test is something you take later, like after you've gotten over those symptoms. And it shows whether you've built up antibodies to this virus. Now, I really caution that because what we've been hearing over and over again is that the antibody test only tells you whether you have antibodies to the virus. It doesn't tell us anything yet, and scientists are certainly studying this, about how long that antibody resistance lasts, whether it means that you're immune for life or whether you're immune for a few months. So even if you were to get that test and you found that you had the antibodies, I would take it with a grain of salt because really, right now, they don't really have a good sense of what having antibodies to the coronavirus actually means. Mm.
Let's take another phone call in Minneapolis. Hannah is on the line. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning.
Hi. Did you have a question or a story to share?
My question was that I haven't seen a lot of reporting on the success of contact tracing. So I was just wondering if there is any feedback from them on how many people are responding and whether they're, does it seem like it's being successful? Are we getting people to quarantine before they show symptoms or spread to anyone else? Are we getting a lot of participation?
Good question.
For the contact tracers.
Thank you. That's Hannah in Minneapolis. And Catherine, what is contact tracing again for people who are not familiar with how that works or the value of that?
Sure. So it actually comes in two parts. The first part is case investigation. So that is when you get a call from either the state or your local public health department to investigate your case. You have been you have tested positive. They're calling you to get more information about where you might have gotten it, where you went while you were infectious, give you advice on isolation. And from there, they get information about who you were in contact with and then do contact tracing. So that's sort of the second step. Now, I haven't reported on this topic in a few months specifically. So I think I can talk sort of more generally about what we've been hearing about it. I haven't done a story on it recently.
Over the summer, we were hearing about wedding receptions and some of the super spreader events.
Yeah. And I think some of the trends that have proven difficult for public health officials to manage started to emerge then. So people were having weddings over the summer. We've heard a number of situations where people had the wedding, someone gets sick, someone else gets sick, they identify a cluster associated with that wedding. And people don't want to talk to public health officials about the fact that they were at that wedding or they were at that large gathering. So that's really where contact tracing falls apart. If people are not, for instance, answering their phone, or if they're not being forthcoming about where they were or who they could have gotten it from, it erodes the entire process. What we know more recently is that some local health departments, including mine, Olmsted County here in Rochester, have basically given up on the process for now because there are just too many cases to keep up on.
I don't have to disclose if I chose to do a get together with some of my colleagues. I don't have to tell you that.
You do not have to tell them that. And, certainly there are people out there, too, who believe that this is not that COVID, COVID is not a pandemic. It's like the flu. So if that's where you're coming from, you might not even respond to that phone call. So I do think they've had trouble keeping up on contact tracing. And I think it's been limited in terms of its benefit to isolating people effectively to make sure it doesn't spread further.
And again, the benefit of it, if you report where you think you got it, what's the benefit again?
The benefit basically allows public health to come up with kind of a map of who you might have infected. And then what they can do is call, let's say, Angela, you got together with a sibling or a best friend, you got sick, you tell the public health official, oh, I was also with my best friend last week, here's her contact information. Then they can call and say, hey, you've come in close contact with someone who's tested positive, you need to isolate for 14 days. You need to quarantine, right? So that basically stops you from spreading that virus. Then you might get information from them to make sure that the people they were in contact with isolates.
Right. Peter, let me ask you more about these long-term care facilities. We know that restrictions on visitors were lifted a few weeks ago. How has that gone, and where do things stand now with visitors?
Right. So in late October, the state started allowing basically all visitors to come in. They're still going through like a screening process. They still have to sign up on a calendar, and a lot of facilities are setting up kind of visiting areas within so people aren't wandering the hallways. It's kind of unclear how much of an effect that's had on case numbers in long-term care. But, given the uptick we've seen in community spread all over the state, it's pretty clear that that's had an effect on deaths in long-term care, either coming in from workers or visitors. But right now, because we've seen such a high rate of positive cases or positive testing in counties, they've shut down visiting in most of the counties in the state. So right now, the only people who can visit are what are called essential caregivers. That's where a resident will pick someone and maybe their family or a friend who can come in to visit, but they've gone through a big screening process, or those end-of-life visits.
And I'm certain that social isolation has been, you know, a topic of conversation quite a bit in many of these homes. Do you hear a lot of that from family members?
Yeah, I think that is a very big concern. Family members and people who are working in these facilities. I mean, we've seen there's a direct connection to physical and mental health. And so when people are isolated, they can deteriorate. But at the same time, having visitors has helped relieve kind of this emotional work and burden that has been on workers in long-term care facilities. Mm. Because, you know, not having visitors, people get lonely. They just want to talk. And right. So a lot of care workers I've talked to, that's been a big part of their work, you know, throughout this pandemic. So visitors really, mm-hmm. exactly.
Right, exactly. Understandable. Phone lines are open, and I want to take a phone call right now from a nurse at a Twin Cities hospital. And good morning to you. What did you want to share with us as we talk about COVID-19 here in Minnesota?
Hi there. Well, I think as a nurse and as a healthcare provider in general, people like to hear how we're doing. I have so many people offering me their gratitude. I have people offering also their condolences. And I just felt like I wanted to share a little bit about what is going on in the hospitals. I know people are pretty aware of the fact that the ICU beds, the med-surg beds, that those are resources that are being stretched thin, that the staff at the hospitals is also being stretched thin. There is a lot of burnout. There are a lot of staffing shortages. There's a lot of crazy busy shifts where we're all just running around because we don't have as many healthcare workers as we need to have. But on top of that, I really feel like there are lots of situations where we're not supported and we're not protected by our employers as well. There have been quite a few situations on my unit, and I think all over the hospital, where you're taking care of a patient who has tested negative. They've come in for some other reason, and because of that, they're assumed to be negative. But it's so frequent that even though they were tested as negative, they weren't really negative. They were possibly infected, but hadn't worked up a high enough level of infectiousness to show that, and will subsequently become symptomatic, develop symptoms, and then all of the healthcare workers that have been taking care of that person were exposed to all their patients within the hospital. And it would really be better if hospitals were having universal precautions, but this is something that they just refuse to do. Even those healthcare workers who have been exposed are told that they need to keep coming to work unless they develop symptoms, which just even compounds the whole risk of how much we're spreading it to each other and to our other vulnerable patients within the hospital, which is another situation that healthcare workers never, ever want to do. I have people telling me all the time to stay safe, and it's something that I stay safe. Friends and family who know what I do, and they tell me to be safe, and it's I'm not allowed to stay safe. The fact that I'm not given N95 respirators at work, the fact that I'm being told to come to work with other people who I know are infected, we are absolutely not in any position. We're not given the support. We're not given the protections so that we can do that.
Now, I should let our listeners know, when you called in, you told our producers that you didn't want us to use your name or to identify what hospital you work at. But do you feel like you speak for a lot of nurses in what
Absolutely.
They're seeing?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is not particular to my hospital. It's not particular to the healthcare system I work in. It's across the board. And I hear the message from the governor that we shut down earlier on so that we could prepare, so we could have the resources that we have. But we're still being told that we don't have those resources. Mm-hmm. We're still being told that we don't have N95. We're still being told that there is one, if you don't fit for an N95, you have to use this other air purification unit, and you maybe have to run 3 units across the hospital to get one because it's the only one around. We're still being told that all the precautions that we know are best for our patients, are best for ourselves, that we can't do it that way.
All right. That's we're hearing from a nurse here in the Twin Cities. Thank you for calling in and sharing what you're seeing. I want to take one more phone call before we go to a news break. In Burnsville, Tom is on the phone. Tom, what did you want to share with us?
I just wanted to say that I think a lot of this is spreading through the workplace still. The reason is we've had OSHA out to my place of business 3 times. And they can never catch the people not wearing their masks. And one reason is the glass storefront, as soon as the customer is seen, everybody puts their mask on. Mm-hmm. The other reason is OSHA has to announce itself as soon as they're there. So naturally, everybody says, oh, OSHA's here, put your mask on. And we've, like I said, we've had them out three times, and they're maintaining that if people are 6 feet apart, that's just fine. They don't have to wear a mask, but which is, you know, not what the governor's mandate states. So I think there's a lot of, because OSHA's got its hands tied and can't, you know, do anything about people not being safe.
Well, Tom, why do you think people are not wearing their mask at work?
Just for anything from, I really don't know why. Most of the people not wearing their mask are younger people that probably would not be affected as badly as a lot of us older people. And we have people as old as 80 years old working. So, you know, they're in the top bracket of being, you know, susceptible. Mm.
And what type of job do you have? What type of industry do you work in again, Tom?
I deliver auto parts.
Auto parts, okay. That's Tom in Burnsville. Thank you for calling in. Catherine, as you hear some of these stories, you know, does this sound familiar in what you're hearing from people you interview?
Yeah, you know, I haven't looked at the numbers recently of clusters associated with workplaces. But yeah, you know, I think that mask mandate continues to be difficult for the state to enforce. There are options for people not to have to wear masks if they have some sort of health condition that would prevent them from doing it. You know, the nurse calling in, really, I just want to say that the story she told me is not new to me. I have heard of similar situations at other hospitals around the state where there has been a high risk exposure and the staff who was exposed is expected to come back in. They might be getting a higher level of testing throughout that quarantine, you know, this period where they might be infectious, they might not, they might have gotten, they might not have. But this really speaks to some of the staffing issues that these hospitals have. Hospitals run very efficiently in normal times. They don't have a ton of staff just lying around, you know, waiting for patients to show up. So this is really where the rubber meets the road between, you know, having enough beds, but if you have enough beds and not enough staff to staff those beds, then those beds are effectively, unusable. So I appreciate her call in.
All right. In St. Paul, I want to hear from Don, who is on the phone. Don, thank you for holding on. What did you want to share with us?
Thank you. Ironically, I just left my dad's senior living facility where I would normally be considered his essential caregiver twice a week for a total of 6 hours. And those hours have now been pulled, and I am now allowed to see him one time a week for 2 hours. Mm. And where I got to see my dad is pulling up in the alley of where he lives. I get out of my car, I call him on the phone, I wear a bright color, and I wave to him, and we communicate that way. So that's one way to bridge this. The other way that I want to say, it's a no-win for nobody. The people that work where my dad lives don't get paid what they deserve for putting their lives on the line. They are pushed to the limit. And as far as the PPE goes, I my heart goes out to that nurse and all of the frontline workers. But that doesn't solve the situation with our elderly. My dad is 92 and dementia, where the touch, when I would go visit him, I would give him a massage, cut his hair, do his toenails and fingernails, listen to jazz music. And he's reverted now to being about, I'm going to say, age 16. He was a former jazz musician, where now he gets into the cool cat sound. And it's, thank goodness I have my mask on and PPE shield so that he can't see me with laughter, because at least he's happy.
Yeah.
But we are in a crisis. And Minnesota, please, people, listen to our governor. This is a serious life or death for all ages. And if we do this together, maybe, just maybe, when the vaccine comes, we can come to the other end of the rainbow. That's what I'm asking. That's what I'm pleading for.
That's Dawn in St. Paul. Thank you, Dawn. And Peter Cox, I'll let you have the last word here. The senior care facilities, it's tough for everyone involved, the families, the residents there, and obviously the workers.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's such a difficult position for everyone, because people want visitors to be able to come in, family members to be able to see loved ones, but they are also trying to protect them and do their job safely. So one other thing is I heard from the industry organization for mm-hmm. long-term care on Friday, and they were just begging people not to bring parents home from either assisted living or other senior housing to Thanksgiving, just because they're so concerned for their health.
All right. Well, I want to appreciate the work of thank my colleagues for the work that they're doing, Catherine Richard and Peter Cox, and for taking some time just to spend a little time, a little analysis of what you're hearing and taking phone calls from our listeners. I appreciate it. Peter Cox, Catherine Richard, thank you. I'll let you get back to work. Well, on Mondays, as you may know, I like to talk about money and how the economy is recovering, trying to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. And each week, NPR senior economics contributor Chris Farrell joins me for our weekly chat. He is back. Hey, Chris.
Good morning, Angela. I've really enjoyed your conversation.
Oh, I know. Well, Catherine, Richard, and Peter Cox and all of our reporters do such a great job, gathering the experiences of people in the community and folks who are working very closely with COVID-19 patients. And, there's a lot to take away from what some of the listeners called in about. But one of the things, that I heard there, the man who works in the auto industry was talking about his colleagues, not wearing their mask or
right.
putting them on real quick when they know that there is someone from OSHA coming to check. And that mask mandate and how we, respond to trying to stop the spread. I mean, that all ties into how the economy is doing.
Absolutely. And if we've learned nothing else from this experience, it's that progress against the coronavirus is good news for the economy and vice versa. I mean, it really has been the story. And I was reading an article from a couple of weeks ago written by Andy Slavitt. He was the former acting administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. He's been writing wonderful stuff. And, he talked about the importance of empathy and kindness during this time, about wearing a mask, social distancing. These are not high-tech solutions. The vaccines are coming, but in the meantime, these are not high-tech solutions, but they can help your coworkers, they can help your colleagues, and they can help your family. And, my heart just goes out to so many people with aging parents that are in an assisted living center or a continuing care community and, not being able to see them during this period of time, but that is going to keep them safe. I've talked to you about my mom, 95 mm-hmm. years old, mm-hmm. healthy, lives in a military retirement community in D.C., and she got invited to 3 Thanksgiving dinners that would be socially distanced, and she's turned them all down. She's lonely, but she wants to stay safe, and she wants other people to stay safe.
Oh, and that's got to be so hard, because I'm sure she does want that social interaction, and even as people try to make all the accommodations that they can, there's still just no guarantee that someone could, that it can be completely safe.
That's right.
We just don't know. So, Chris, let's talk about the current state of the economy. Of course, you have good news and bad news.
Of course. So let's start with the good news. And, the good news really right now, at least the last couple of weeks, has been this progress on the vaccine. And AstraZeneca, that's the latest announcement. Their vaccine's around 90% effective. So now we have 3, Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca. And as Ian Bremmer of the Eurasian Group, he's a consultant, and as he put it, vaccine rollout is now Biden's top political priority by a long margin. So the first 100 days, traditionally when we talk about the first 100 days of a new president, mm-hmm. that they matter, and that really kind of came out of the Roosevelt administration for the New Deal and the Great Depression. Well, the first 100 days with the president-elect Biden's administration are going to be absolutely critical with distribution of the vaccines.
And so what, the distribution of it, I mean, how will they even decide? Does anyone know how this is going to work? You've got 3 different manufacturers. Who will your doctor's office decide what you get if you choose to get it? I'm confused by all of it.
Well, part of the problem, and you're right to be confused by all, we all are, because the Trump administration at this particular point in time doesn't seem to be doing much to try and contain the virus. I assume that the professionals, Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci I mean, that they're continuing to come up with plans. But the initial idea is that it would go for certain priorities. So, for example, healthcare workers, the frontline workers,
they're
a priority. The elderly, they're the people that Peter Cox covers and was talking about when you're having your conversation with him. So it would be more targeted in terms of the most vulnerable. And then you would move from there.
All right. Chris, as we talk about the economy, we're getting phone calls in already, folks who have some questions for you. So I want to get to those as soon as we can. In Minnetonka, Ken is on the phone. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I am a baby boomer, and my question is that I have some money in the stock market. I guess it is about the stock market is my question. I have a certain amount there, and I'm lucky enough, I have a house, a second house, and I'm a baby boomer. And right now, on Friday last week, I was kind of positive, optimistic about things. Obviously, the market goes up and down. Today, I was kind of positive as well, as the way it goes. But over the weekend, I was not. I was really kind of negative and thinking about, the future, not only because of different administration, but because... just because things may change significantly. What do I do? That's my question.
Sure. And a lot of people are asking this. And by the way, I have a perspective on the stock market. But who knows? So you can't control what the stock market is going to do. You can't control what the economy is going to do. Whereas we have a conversation, we'll lay out various scenarios, what might possibly happen. So what is it that you can control? So when you're raising the question like that you did, and so many people are, and it's an important question, you can't control what's going to happen to the stock market. And you shouldn't listen to me or anybody else when it comes to what is going to happen to the stock market. What you can control is your own finances and your own what you need to spend. What are your basic expenses? What do you need to spend in order to, pay your insurance on your home and bills for your food? And then what are your desires above that, the things that add to your quality of life? And so you make sure that you have that money, plus a little bit extra just in case something good comes along or something bad comes along. So focus on what it is that you can control, your expenses, your desires, your quality of life, and then match money to those expenses. Then you can put a certain amount, if you want, continue to expose that to the stock market on the off chance that it might do well. And if it goes down, you have a couple years set up where you don't have to worry about it if the stock market goes down. So focus on your expenses and your desires and your quality of life and matching your money to that.
Chris, let's talk about the job market. Everybody I know, myself included, we're all worried about our jobs. Are we going to have jobs in 6 months, in a year? What are we seeing with the job market?
So that is exactly the right question, because it's the next 6 months that are so nerve-wracking. Right? Because we know there are going to be some vaccines. And I don't think it's just being starry-eyed optimism that, the vaccines are going to have an effect. But we're getting into later into 2021. We got to get to that period of time. And, many businesses are, starting to lay off people. Southwest Airlines doing well, but it just told over 400 workers that they might be furloughed. And New York's MTA, they said that 9,300 jobs are at risk. And the big banks, they've been being very clear that they expect to reduce their workforces because companies are adjusting to this lower revenue world that we're living in. Holiday season doesn't look like it's going to be great. It's going to be okay, but it's not going to be great. And how many businesses are going to fold when the holiday season isn't as they expected? So that is absolutely the real risk. And this is one of the things, Angela, that truly upsets me, which is millions of people could lose their unemployment benefits by the end of December. Because remember the CARES Act? That was the one that was passed back in July. And that lets states do their pandemic unemployment assistance. And these are individuals who self-employed, couldn't qualify for under the regular unemployment insurance system. So they could get it, but also extended unemployment benefits. Well, that all expires by the end of December. So without action to help people, we could really see the ranks of the unemployed grow again, and we could really see people suffering as their source of support dries up.
Chris, let's take another phone call from one of our listeners. As we talk about the economy, the job market, and how folks are doing with their money matters, the number is 651-227-6000 if you want to join the conversation. In Moorhead, Nicholas is on the phone. Good morning, Nicholas.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, we've been hearing a lot about different industries that have been heavily affected and wiped or decimated by the pandemic. What are some industries that may have been changed but are still going well? For example, I have family members that work in the healthcare and education in, industries. Their jobs have been affected, but they still have them.
Right. So, yeah. So one of the sectors that is doing extremely well is the tech sector, and tech sector broadly defined. So anything that's helping us, you know, order goods that are delivered to home, working from home. So if you look at sort of the digital economy broadly defined, it's doing very well. I mean, doing incredibly well, and it's showing up in the stock prices of a lot of the tech companies. The warehouse industry, broadly defined, warehouse industry employment is way up, even as retail sales employment is down in the latest employment numbers. So if you look at the digital economy and you sort of spread that out and it's taking deeper root in our economy, you look at the whole delivery service business, they're doing much better than expected. A lot of the consultants and professional services businesses are doing better around the country during this period of time.
Chris, what do we know about the unemployment rate here in Minnesota? What are the latest numbers showing with that?
Yeah, so the latest number, I mean, Minnesota's unemployment rate fell to 4.6% in October. So that, I mean, look, 4.6%, okay.
That sounds good.
Sounds good. But the problem was indeed the department
economic.
I always get it.
Employment and economic development.
I always get the economic and the employment mixed up there. Employment and economic development. As I said that, for the second month in a row, the improvement in the unemployment rate reflected people dropping out of the labor market. So the labor force.
What does that mean? They just stopped
they
looking
just gave
for
up.
Work. They gave up.
They gave up for now. I mean, obviously they gave up. It wasn't worth it for them to continue to be looking for jobs. And so the labor force participation rate went down. And, you know, there has been some job growth. Of course, but it's not as good a number as it would appear on the surface, and I would expect that we'll with the what's going on right now in terms of pulling back. And by the way, it's not just Minnesota that's pulling back on, as you were talking about with the bars and the gyms and a number of other industries. That's happening in many, many places around the country now with the coronavirus and the death toll mounting.
And Chris, you know, it's always important to me to talk about racial disparities. And so when we look at some of the information from Deed, we know that communities of colors continue to be more deeply affected by the economic impact of COVID-19.
So, you know, they did this calculation from May to October 2020, and the unemployment rate for Black Minnesotans, 15.4%. And that's up more than 10 percentage points from 1 year ago. So it was 5.3% one year ago. And for Latinx Minnesotans, 9.6%, up from 2.6% a year ago. So these are very disturbingly high numbers.
Yeah.
And just to add to this, we really do have two economies here in Minnesota. So if you are earning $60,000 and more, your employment growth rate, you know, you're back to where you were in January, which is what a lot of people are using as sort of their benchmark in order to say pre-pandemic. However, you still have very high, low employment rates when it comes to people who earn $27,000 or less.
Let's take another phone call. Chris, in Duluth, Jeff is on the phone. And Jeff, as we talk about the economy, what did you want to share with us?
Yeah, thank you. I'm very optimistic about our future. I mean, I love our country. I think we're going to be coming together. But I work in the electrical industry, and we are hiring in the electrical industry. There's a great future in the electrical industry. General Electric stock is affordable now. You can buy, invest in electrical industry. There's always constant innovation, but Volkswagen's going to be coming out with an electric car in a couple of years. Tesla is succeeding. The electrical industry is booming, and it will be improving, because even as we get these storms and you got to replace the wiring that breaks, I mean, there's so mm-hmm. much going on in the industry that it's, if you ever want to look for something that's future and optimistic, from consumer goods to hiring to investment opportunities, look to the electrical industry.
So, Jeff, I have a question. So some people now are, you know, searching for new skills or trying to get training in something else to look for a different kind of job. So this is a career path you would suggest?
Yes. Oh, I wish I was 20 years old. I'd become an electrician. There are jobs up in northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin. The average age of an electrician now is like the dairy farmer. I mean, 50, 60 something years old. We need electricians. We need people to work in the industry, as well as to, there's always constant innovation. So it's a great future. Don't be so pessimistic. America is the greatest country on
Jeff,
earth.
I love this.
One more question for Jeff. Where can you go get training if you were interested in becoming an electrician? What are some possibilities?
Well, these community colleges are a great opportunity. I don't even think there's a waiting list anymore. But you can go to any of these big electrical companies. They're hiring. They will train.
Oh.
Even if you wanted to be a customer service assistant. I'm just saying, really, for people of all ages, I work in industry myself. And there's just so much opportunity. It's actually unheard of.
Thank you. That's Jeff in Duluth. I love his optimism. I love his good advice.
Well, it is good. It is excellent advice. And that optimism is really important. And the optimism, I say, about where this economy is going once the coronavirus is in the rearview mirror, the optimism is not just magical thinking. I mean, there's some very important changes in our economy that suggest we're going to get a lot of business investment. And he hit on one of the areas where you're going to see a lot of business investment. But he's also hit on an area in our economy where he's absolutely right. You have an older workforce, and whether it's electricity or it's plumbing or it's machining. And so there are genuine opportunities there. The community college typically is one route. And again, he's very smart about, a lot of companies now are much more willing to train their workers than they were in the past. So yes, he's right to be optimistic about many changes. And I also think with the new administration coming in, if they're able to do some of the investments that they would like to do on the green economy, which is feeding into what he was talking about, more research and development, more spending in terms of establishing for creating jobs for wind turbine and for solar, that, you know, there are going to be incredible opportunities in a number of businesses.
And Chris, what can you say to people who are holding on to hope that Washington will pass another fiscal relief package?
Well, what I would love to do is say that I wish I was hopeful. And what I do believe what will happen is that when the newest administration comes into power, that we will see a relief package. So it's going to be tough for people to get there. There is a small chance that we'll see some sort of small package before then, that the Democrats and Republicans may come together and decide to do something very quick, relatively small. I think that everybody would go for that deal. If it happens, part of the problem is the president of the United States is totally disengaged from the process. And so that's why I don't have particularly high hopes for it, but I do have high hopes that come the swearing in of the new administration, we'll see something very quickly.
And I think as much as so many of us want 2020 to be gone and done, 2021 presents a lot of challenges.
2021 is going to be, at least at the beginning, a continuation of at least some of the trends that we've been talking about. The CDC just came in, it came over the wires, that they now are predicting, you know, and obviously there's that another 30,000 Americans could die by the end of the Christmas holiday season. Now, what Minnesota's doing and some other states hopefully will lower that number. So the virus doesn't respect the calendar. So, you know, we need more coordinated action, more testing, and hopefully we see a lot of that in the new year.
And in our last minute and a half here, a lot of folks already are decorating for the holidays. And I've just been curious about, like, with buying gifts and sending gifts, are we going to see that this year? Because no one's going anywhere or doing anything. What does that mean for retail?
Well, I think for retail, a lot of it is going to be done online, and that, which is going to be very hard on local businesses that don't have an online presence. This is going to be, you know, a year where the chains who do have an online presence are probably going to do fairly well. And by the way, if you are going to be shopping for the holiday season, the deliverers have made it very clear, do your shopping early.
Because it's taking longer for everything to get there.
Yeah.
Right. And holiday workers, you see some places, do you think they'll hire like seasonal workers?
They are hiring seasonal workers. And so that is going on. A lot of the seasonal work that's being hired, the warehouses are obviously critical, but a lot of it is also being done online. So helping out their frontline workers, hiring people seasonal to be doing some of the back office work.
There's our music. We got to go, Chris.
All right.
Chris Farrell, thank you.
Thank you.
Our senior economics contributor. Remember, at 12:30 this afternoon, about half an hour, you can hear from Governor Walz here live on NPR News with an announcement about technology, a new app that might help us. This conversation was produced by NPR's Karen Zamora.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis NPR. And if you missed us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. Thanks for listening.